take a moment to let your body settle. Drop your jaw and feel relaxation spreading from that over your head and face. And as you breathe in, be aware of your chest and shoulders and back stretching upwards. And then as you breathe out, feel the chest settle, and then the shoulders settle, and then the back settle. And let the relaxation spread over the front of your torso, down your arms, into your hands, and over your back. And also be aware of the legs being still and restful, while at the same time being aware of the relaxation in your face so that the whole body feels settled and still. And for a moment, focus on the pleasant sensation of that global relaxation. Now be aware. Feelings are arising within your body. Thoughts are arising within your mind. Sights and sounds are arising from your surroundings. Even with your eyes closed, there may be some light, some visual impact. Some sense of surrounding space and seeing your situation. And certainly sounds are present. And perhaps even smell and taste. Be aware of the flow of your senses. Hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body and the thinking mind. These are the six doors of perception. We're going to analyze the moment-by-moment flow of experience that comes through these six doors of perception in terms of two categories. Those aspects of your experience that you consider to be your sense of self, and those aspects of your experience that you consider to be other. The sense of self will probably involve certain kinds of thoughts and feelings, The sense of other will involve sights and sounds, but also certain kinds of thoughts and feelings you may perceive as relating to other rather than yourself. In terms of these two categories, there are no absolutes. Whatever you choose to call self is what self is for you at that moment. Whatever you choose to call other is other for you at that moment. But I'd like you to, moment by moment, analyze your experience with clarity into these two fundamental categories. And if you're not sure, a guess is okay. The borders of the categories may be nebulous. That's okay. But at any given moment, there are only three possibilities as far as your experience goes. You will either find that you are only aware of your sense of self, or that you are only aware of a sense of other, or that you are simultaneously aware of the arising of both self and other. When you hear a sound, in that moment there may be just the sound that would be other. When you become self-conscious, in that moment there may be just self-consciousness, the sense of an observer, a controller, a will, then that would be only the sense of self. Or it could happen that at the very instant you hear a sound, you're also aware of a you hearing the sound, self and other arising simultaneously. There is no preference between these three situations. Each is as good as the other one is. Let your awareness freely float within the sensory field. And when it seems that you're pulled to a perception of what is other than you, say to yourself, other. When you're pulled into a sense of yourself, say self. And if you are aware of both arising at the same time, say to yourself the word both. You may be primarily aware of self or other, or it may be primarily both at the same time. The purpose of this step in the meditation is to merely clarify what the natural flow pattern is at this time. And when the sense of self arises, accept that sense of self. Try not to interfere with it. Infuse it with clarity and gentleness. And likewise, when the sense of other arises, do the same. Now, if you find that the labeling gets in the way, feel free to drop it. But be aware, at any given moment, there are only three possibilities, and they are mutually exclusive and exhaustive. You will either be experiencing a sense of self with no other, or a sense of other with no self, or both arising as a single arising simultaneously. At each transition, each new self, each new other, each new both, relax into it, open up to it. The job is very simple. Just be clear about the configuration of consciousness with respect to these categories moment by moment. And at each transition in the categories, relax into it, open up to it. And let it happen. Let nature take its course. We're going to move to another phase, one of selective attention. Focus only on the sense of other. For a little while, ignoring the sense of self, even though it may arise very strongly. try to keep a continuous awareness on just that aspect of experience that would be other, although it may be a different other each moment. A sound now, a sight then. It may be a sound now, and then it may be a sight. And then it may be a memory, but a memory of something other than you. The other is constantly arising. The great majority of the universe is other. Now, let go of that and focus as much as possible continuously only on your sense of self, whatever it may be that produces that, those thoughts, those feelings. That you perceive of as self, the sense of observer, the sense of controller, the sense of will, the sense of an experiencer, moment by moment. Stay continuous with that, ignoring anything that arises that would seem to be other, to the best of your ability. let go of that exclusive focus on the sense of self. And once again, allow the awareness to freely float through the sensory field. And observe how when you're pulled to the sense of other, the sense of self may weaken a little bit. And when you're pulled to the sense of self, the sense of other may weaken a little bit. And if you're able to detect that, go with it. When you're pulled to the sense of other, let the so-called other expand. And be willing to let the sense of self contract at the same time. When you're pulled to the sense of self, unblock it. Don't fight with it. Don't tighten around it. Let the sense of self expand. And the sense of other contract. Expansion simply means allowing it to get large and clear. Contraction simply means allowing it to get small and faint. And if both arise at the same time, then relax into that experience. And let the sense of self and other arise as a single unity. Not necessarily separate. Let go of that, and once again, try to focus as continuously as possible on just the sense of self. Selectively attend to that. And be aware. The sense of self usually involves both feeling and thinking, both body sensation and concept. See if you can detect moment by moment what part of your sense of self consists of feeling, body, and what part of your sense of self consists of thought, mind. And relax into the states of mind and body that produce the sense of self. Try to let them flow without inhibition. Continue to do that. And be aware how this sense of self may change moment by moment. It may get stronger, it may get weaker. It may shift, like looking at a picture from different angles. Same face, but it looks different. And become fascinated with the dynamic or changing qualities of the sense of self. The change may be very subtle. Each new arising of will, of control, of self-image, the sense of a doer, the sense of a perceiver, are constantly shifting, albeit perhaps subtly. Become so fascinated with the subtle ways in which the sense of self may change that you become less fixated on the sense of self as a thing and begin to experience it more as an activity, a flow, a wave rather than a particle. Energy rather than matter. A verb rather than a noun. We entitled this series, The Science of Enlightenment. But in point of fact, it probably would be more accurate to describe it as a science of enlightenment. There are a number of sciences of enlightenment. They differ in where they put their emphasis and in their model, their paradigm, their vocabularies. However, all the sciences of enlightenment have a certain overlap between them. Some things are absolutely universal. And what I've tried to do is present to you some of the elements that are universal. Certainly, the cultivation of high concentration is a universal element. Any science of enlightenment will make use of this. And the element of equanimity. That's universal also, although the vocabulary used may not be the exact word equanimity. All around the world, when one looks at the various sciences of enlightenment, one finds that the elements of high concentration and equanimity or detachment are found there. Another element that is usually found in a science of enlightenment is morality, some sort of moral basis. In Buddhism, morality is pretty simple. There are four fundamental, what are called sila, that have to do with not taking life, not stealing, not telling falsehoods, and not doing things that are sexually harmful to people. And a fifth optional morality, which is not taking intoxicants. Other sciences of enlightenment have more elaborate moral systems. The particular emphasis in this series is based on the tradition which in Buddhism is called vipassana meditation, V-I-P-A-S-S-A-N-A. And that's a word in the Pali language, which is one of the ancient languages of India, but not as ancient as Sanskrit. Vipassana in English is sometimes called mindfulness meditation because the emphasis is on being very precise about ordinary experience. But it's sometimes called insight meditation because as the result of being precise about ordinary experience, our understandings grow and change in very significant ways, and a kind of wisdom arises that is sometimes referred to as insight. However, the vipassana or mindfulness or insight approach to meditation is only one of several Buddhist approaches, and Buddhism is only one of the world's mystical traditions. What I'd like to do in this talk is provide for you concentrically broader perspectives on the big picture, the worldwide picture, where this all fits in to world spirituality, how it all fits in more broadly with human history and what the implications might be for the future. So it's for that reason that I entitled this talk, The Big Picture. There is a simple way that a person can remember the basic picture as far as Buddhism goes. Of course, whenever one gives an oversimplification, detail is left out and there's some distortions involved. But if you want to get an overview, sort of what is the big picture of just the Buddhist tradition, keeping just a couple things in mind is very helpful. Buddhist history is very long, 2,500 years. So it's a long stretch in time. And Buddhism is spread over vast areas of space, mostly in Asia, but now also in the West. It has encountered different cultures, different ethnic groups. Within Buddhism, there have been individuals who were great meditators, but there were also individuals who didn't understand meditation at all, but had a lot of intellectual activities, philosophical speculation. Buddhism had to evolve cultural norms for the different areas and different ages. Taken as a whole, the Buddhist tradition is extremely rich and complex. And there is a danger when one starts to study Buddhism that you might miss the forest because of the trees. There's just so much detail that it's hard to get a sense of the big picture of what Buddhism is about in its broadest outlines. So what I would like to do is try to provide you with that sort of broad framework. And then within that broad framework, you can plug in more specific detail. Broadly speaking, Buddhism went through three periods of development in its native land of India. You're probably aware that the historical Buddha, who was known as Prince Siddhartha Gautama, lived approximately 2,500 years ago in North India, actually more Northeast India. Roughly North India, actually more Northeast India. Roughly speaking, the first 500 years after his death, Buddhism preserved a style of meditation, a lifestyle similar to what he had set up. Similar, we don't know, identical, but objective scholarship feels it's fairly similar. Then about 500 years after his death, changes started to take place. Some people preserved the older style of Buddhism, but other people evolved a new style of Buddhism. That new style of Buddhism was called Mahayana, or the great vehicle. Maha means great, and yana means vehicle. In contrast to that, the older forms of Buddhism were named Hinayana, meaning the small vehicle. Obviously, this is a pejorative term, a term that was created by the great vehicle people to put down the earlier forms of Buddhism. Put down, that's perhaps even too strong a word. These groups never fought with each other. They never persecuted each other. They never said, you're going to go to hell. They never did the kinds of things that we tend to associate with sectarian rivalry in the Western tradition. There were never any crusades, jihads, or inquisitions, or anything remotely resembling that. But there was a difference in emphasis, that's for sure. Mahayana developed for about 700 years, actually, until it evolved into a third phase of Buddhist history, once again in India. We're not talking about outside of India quite yet. And that third phase is called Vajrayana, which means the diamond vehicle. Vajra is a diamond. Unfortunately, Vajra has another meaning. It means a thunderbolt. It means both diamond and thunderbolt at the same time. Vajrayana evolved out of Mahayana, and in some ways is sort of the culmination of Mahayana, but it has a lot of peculiarities that are distinctive to it. The Hinayana period, 500 years roughly, the Mahayana period, 700 years roughly, the Vajrayana period, another 500 years roughly, takes us to approximately the end of the 12th century, approximately the year 1200. At that time, Northeast India was finally overrun by Muslim invaders. They destroyed the monastic colleges that had been the center of the Buddhist community in that part of the world. That was pretty much a death blow to Buddhism in its native soil, and Buddhism gradually disappears from India. Prior to that, though, each of these three movements within Buddhism was propagated out, mostly eastward, into Asia. In India, the three movements, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, coexisted. They would even live in the same temples. One didn't replace the other, it's just that they were successive evolutions and a person would follow one or the other or maybe all three vehicles, study all three vehicles. Although each of these three approaches spread widely, various historical circumstances have led to the early Buddhist tradition, the, quote, small vehicle, being preserved primarily in Southeast Asia, particularly in Thailand, Burma, and Sri Lanka. Likewise, the Mahayana tradition, although it spread very broadly, is primarily associated with Eastern Asia, what used to be called the Far East. And the hub, of course, of East Asia, the center of that Kulturkreis, or cultural sphere that we call the Far East, is China. Mahayana Buddhism came into China, went through a period of many centuries of nativization to China. It was modified, it was Sinified, made Sino, made Chinese, until finally it evolved into a truly native Chinese expression of Buddhism, quite different in many aspects from Indian Mahayana, but Mahayana nonetheless. There were a number of Chinese schools that developed that were of significance. Most of them are not known in the West. There was a school called Tiantai, for example, another school called Pure Land, Jingku in Chinese. There was a school called Huayan. These are unknown in the West, although they're very important for East Asia. However, one school, a school that emphasized meditation a lot, but also meditated in a way quite different from any Indian predecessor. One school is very well known in the West. It is the school that in Chinese is called Chan. And Chan just means meditation. Actually, Chan is an abbreviation of Chana. And Chana is the Chinese transliteration into Chinese characters of the Sanskrit word Dhyana, which, as you know, is one of the words for a state of deep meditation. They were called the Chan, or meditators, because they meditated a lot, but there's much more to it than that. The Tantai school meditated too. What was more to it is that the Chan school, which arose in the Tang Dynasty, which was many centuries after Buddhism came into China. Buddhism came into China approximately the beginning of the Christian era, just as Mahayana was really starting to develop. And it came into China through the Central Asian trade routes, what's called the Silk Road. But it didn't develop into Chan until many, many, many centuries later, basically the 8th, 9th centuries. It took all those centuries to digest Indian Buddhism and make it Chinese. And basically what happened is that the Chan people were meditators. They did a lot of meditation. But they didn't just sit and meditate. They also got enlightened, deeply enlightened, as a result of that meditation. Enlightened enough that they felt confident significantly modifying Buddhism as they had received it from India, significantly modifying its description of things, significantly modifying the style of monastic life. Instead of just copying something from a foreign culture, from India, they changed it to be comfortable for them, the Chinese. They significantly modified the paradigm or description of what enlightenment is all about. They brought in Confucian elements. They brought in Taoist elements. They had the confidence to create a native form of Buddhism. That confidence could only come about if they were almost as enlightened as the Buddha himself. The school called Chan propagated into the parts of Asia that are culturally under direct Chinese influence. Japan, where it's called Zen, Korea, where it's called Sun, and Vietnam, where it's called Tian. That whole East Asia world, although there are a number of schools of Buddhism there, the one that is most known and of worldwide importance is the so-called Zen, or Chan. Historically speaking, it merely represents a Chinese modification, profound reworking of Mahayana Buddhism. Vajrayana also spread throughout the Asian world, but is now primarily confined to the Himalaya, Tibet cultural area. I should say, however, that a trickle of it did get into East Asia and is preserved to this day as the Shingon school. And that is the school that I was ordained in 1970. But broadly speaking, you have three historical periods in India correlated with three geographical regions of Asia. Early Buddhism, the small vehicle, primarily in Southeast Asia, Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka. Mahayana, the great vehicle, modified and spread in primarily in East Asia, China, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. And then this Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, the last phase of Buddhism, primarily associated with Tibet, Nepal, that area. This is the time-space framework against which you can see the Buddhist tradition. But what characterizes these three vehicles? Broadly speaking, there are two possible views as to what the historical development of Buddhism is. You can say that as time passed, Buddhism evolved. Issues that had not been fully dealt with in early Buddhism were dealt with in the later vehicles. Approaches that had not been known in early Buddhism were discovered and proved to be useful. So we can look upon Buddhist history as an evolution. From that point of view, Buddhism culminates in Vajrayana. Equally, one could choose to look at it from the opposite perspective, that there was this original teaching that was unique in many aspects in terms of world religions. And gradually, Buddhism evolved over time, got more and more corrupt. And the things that were so attractive in early Buddhism, its denial of the role of authority, its denial of superstition, its denial of a hierarchical power structure, its denial of ritualism, its denial of social caste system, etc. All of these things were lost, and Buddhism gradually gets more and more and more just like any other religion. And the culmination of that degradation process is reached in the Vajrayana. I'm quite prepared to argue either of these scenarios, by the way. I can certainly see it from both points of view. However, that is a theme, and you can decide for yourself. To what extent does Buddhism improve over the centuries? To what extent does it become degraded over the centuries? And what is the interplay of expansive and contractive forces that mold the thing called Buddhist history? Since our series is primarily about practice and practical experiences, I'll limit myself just to those aspects. You may be familiar with the story of the historical Buddha, Prince Siddhartha Gautama. He left his father's palace in order to search for a state of happiness independent of conditions. In other words, an answer to the issue of human suffering. He first sought out a couple of teachers who were masters of high concentration and absorptive trance. He was something of a spiritual genius, Prince Siddhartha Gautama, sort of like what Mozart was to music, he was to meditation. He was able to master these techniques very quickly. His teachers said that when you enter into the deepest state of concentration, when your physiological functions more or less suspend, there is this state of bliss and peacefulness